Well, the body has a very clever mechanism for preventing blood loss. Obviously, if you're injured and you begin to lose blood, if there's no mechanism for controlling this, then you'd quickly die from excessive blood loss. Now, the body has two or three systems which it employs. One of these is in the blood plasma itself, which is a clotting system, whereby proteins become almost like a sort of semi-rigid net around the site of the wound or the cut. Another feature of it is the constriction of the blood vessels around the site of the wound to prevent the flow of blood. But thirdly is the operation of small cells in the blood called platelets. These are tiny little cells, and they're rather abnormal in many ways because they don't have a nucleus like most cells. They're more like little fragments of a cell, but they have very, very specialized role in controlling blood loss because they clump together and form a plug which blocks up the exit of the blood from the wound. And this can occur very, very rapidly, and the plug becomes very, very stable very, very quickly. Whilst platelets and blood clotting mechanisms are designed to protect you against injury and blood loss, sometimes they go wrong. And a particular case in point is during a disease called atherosclerosis. So in this disease, you get fatty deposits in the blood vessels, and these cause damage, and platelets sense this damage, and they begin to stick at the sites of the fatty deposits. When they do this, they may build up into quite a large clump, and they may also be associated with clotting proteins at the same site, which have deposited for the same reason. And if these break off, then they can be very dangerous. For example, if this happens in an artery, then the resulting platelet and protein plug may find its way around and get lodged in the heart or the brain, potentially causing a lot of damage. And we tend to refer to this as a stroke, for example, or a myocardial infarction. So to combat this, there are various types of drugs that can be used, but they act at different points on the system. There's a range of drugs called blood clotting, well, we call them simply blood clotting agents, and these prevent the clotting of blood in various ways. One which is often used by patients is a drug called warfarin, but increasingly people are using aspirin in the same way because aspirin prevents prostaglandins from being synthesized by the platelets and prevents them from aggregating. And a very low dose of aspirin, for example, about 70, 75 milligrams per day, is all that's required to prevent platelets from becoming overactivated in this way. So it's a very common use for aspirin these days. Aspirin is actually a very simple derivative of salicylic acid, and it was marketed in the late 1890s by a German pharmaceutical company called Bayer, and it was very quickly shown to be superior to salicylic acid in its effects. So what are the effects of aspirin? Well, there are three main therapeutic effects. First of all, it reduces inflammation. Secondly, it reduces pain. And thirdly, it reduces fever. It also has a side effect of causing gastric damage, which is very, very prominent in about 30% of the people who take it. So in order to understand how aspirin works, we have to understand another advance which was happening in the late 60s and early 1970s. People had discovered that there was a group of biologically active substances called prostaglandins. They were originally called prostaglandins because they were thought to be found mainly in the prostate gland. But this turned out to be an error, but the name sort of remained. Turns out that prostaglandins can be made by virtually all cells in the body, and that they're often made in response to injury or infection or some sort of cell stress. And some of these prostaglandins have very interesting properties. So, for example, They have inflammatory properties. They can cause fever and they can cause pain. And they can also protect the stomach against insult and injury. The reason why cells can make prostaglandins is because they have an enzyme, that's to say a protein that catalyzes a biochemical reaction. They have an enzyme which became known as the fatty acid cyclooxygenase, normally referred to as COX, COX. So this enzyme can combine some fatty acids with molecular oxygen to form these prostaglandins. And this enzyme is stuck onto the membranes of cells and is very, very difficult to remove it. So all the early experiments that were done with aspirin-like drugs and prostaglandins used quite crude preparations of cell extracts in order to generate prostaglandins for assay. This was a nuisance because it meant that you couldn't really get to understand very much about the enzyme itself, although you could make allowances for it in various ways, which everybody had to, because it took years of development and research before the technique for removing the enzyme off the membrane became widely used. And once this was achieved, it was possible to purify the enzyme completely, so it was a single protein. And when that had been done, and we're talking 1990s here, when that had been done, it was possible to crystallize it. And once it had been crystallized, using a technique called X-ray crystallography, it was possible to build up a model of the enzyme, and we could see how it worked and how aspirin and the other drugs interfered with its action to prevent it from working. As we became more expert in understanding the effect of the aspirin-like drugs, people began to notice some anomalies in their ability to inhibit prostaglandin formation in different tissues. And the question was, why was this? The mystery was solved in the early 90s when it was discovered that there was another type of cyclooxygenase enzyme. And this was remarkably similar to the original type of cyclooxygenase, with one exception really, and that was that unlike the original cyclooxygenase, which we then began to call COX-1 or cyclooxygenase 1, this enzyme only normally appeared during episodes of inflammation, injury, or infection. This new enzyme became known as COX-2, and as we came to understand its properties, it seemed to us that maybe this was the enzyme really that should be the target for the aspirin-like drugs, because the other enzyme, COX-1, was important for running the physiology of the body as well as any role it might have in inflammation. For example, in the stomach, it was known that COX-1 was important in generating prostaglandins, which had a protective effect on the stomach wall. So this idea became known as the COX-1 good, COX-2 bad hypothesis. And when we tested all the aspirin-like drugs, it was found that virtually all of them inhibited both enzymes to some degree or other. This caused people to think that perhaps a more selective inhibitor of the cyclooxygenase 2 would enable us to produce a drug which was a good anti-inflammatory agent without, for example, causing damage to the stomach. This led to a release onto the market of several COX-2 selective inhibitors, or COXIBs, as they've become known. They were shown to have significantly less gastric side effects than the old-fashioned aspirin-like drugs, if you want to call them those. However, it was noticed during one trial that patients taking these COX-2 inhibitors appeared to develop adverse cardiovascular effects. That's to say, there was an increase in the incidence of stroke, myocardial infarction, and other cardiovascular diseases. This caused general alarm and panic in the community, with the effect that eventually some of these drugs were withdrawn from general use. The reason why this occurs is a bit controversial, but it prompted people to look at all the aspirin-like drugs, including the old-fashioned ones, including aspirin itself. And it was found out, I think to most people's amazement, that all these drugs could cause the same type of cardiovascular effects. And this seemed to be down to their ability to cause an increase in blood pressure. I should say that in order to see this, you normally had to treat for fairly long periods of time with fairly large doses of these drugs. But nevertheless, they all seem to have the same effect. I think this was a big surprise to everyone. When aspirin was first used to treat patients with rheumatoid arthritis, they would often have to take 6 to 9 grams of aspirin a day. So 6 grams is about 18 tablets, which is a huge amount. And aspirin is one of the most toxic drugs on the gastric mucosa, and these big doses led to a lot of problems. So with the advent of the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, aspirin was really dropped as an anti-inflammatory agent in these very, very large doses. It was still used as an analgesic agent and an antipyretic in much smaller doses. The doses for treating those conditions are really just a couple of tablets every 4 hours or so, which is a completely different proposition from taking 6 to 9 grams a day. But even so, most people get on better with drugs like paracetamol than aspirin itself. However, the real breakthrough was the discovery that very, very tiny amounts of aspirin could affect platelets. And the reason for this is a bit unusual, but if you give a very tiny amount of aspirin, it's only absorbed, it only has an effect in the blood that is draining the gastrointestinal tract. And what happens is the aspirin can interfere with the platelets in that blood, but by the time that blood gets to the liver, most of the free aspirin in the blood is destroyed. So this means that virtually no aspirin in this dose gets into the general circulation, and therefore its toxicity is hugely reduced. So that's the reason why aspirin is a very useful cardiovascular drug in low doses, but is no longer used really to treat inflammation. But another area, and that's to say the treatment of cancer with aspirin, has actually shown some promise. This is an area which has been bubbling along for many years, and I think it's now well established that in some particular types of colon cancer, then the growth of the polyps in the colon can be prevented by taking low-dose aspirin. And I think this has been very well established, and I think that these drugs now form part of a fairly regular treatment regime. What's perhaps more controversial and more difficult to understand is the claim, and it's often based on good evidence, that aspirin may prevent other types of cancer, for example, breast cancer. What's slightly mysterious about this is the mechanism through which it occurs. Is it an effect on the cyclooxygenase enzyme, which we're seeing here? Is it because, for example, prostaglandins in some way can control or modulate tumour growth? Or is there some other action of aspirin that we haven't yet discovered? I think this is where there's a lot of interest in the area at the moment, and I look forward to some time in the future when this whole matter has been resolved, but it is very interesting. 1982 was a very important year for us in our lab, because that was the year that John Vane won the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize is, of course, the most celebrated prize awarded to scientists, and the Nobel Committee tends to award the prize to areas of research as much as to talented individuals. And in this particular case, the area to be rewarded, as it were, was the area of prostaglandin research, which had become very, very interesting, and lots of therapeutic ideas seemed to be coming out of this area. The prize was awarded to Sune Bergström, who was one of the Swedish scientists who was responsible for the purification of prostaglandins when they were first discovered, and did a lot of work on their biochemistry. Bengt Samuelsson was the second person. He was responsible for understanding how prostaglandins were biosynthesized by this enzyme, the cyclooxygenase. And the third person, of course, was John Vane, whose work on aspirin had shown why the prostaglandins were very important in pathology, but also his work had given scientists very useful tools with which to probe the actions of prostaglandins in normal physiology as well. So 1982 was a landmark year, and some of us decamped to Stockholm in the winter to see John receive his Nobel Medal. And I suppose it was one of the memories that remains in our collective mind for the longest. It was a very happy and significant time.